Okay, so our topic is learning to listen, an adventure in unnatural behavior. Okay, so we're going to start off this morning, and my wife and I are going to mime this a little bit. I'm going to sit down here like I'm on a chair. She's going to come up, and we're going to have this conversation. I'm sitting here reading a book.
I'm really worried about my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I just talked to her, and she just really sounds off somehow.
Mm.
I think I should be there for her, but I just don't know how I can be.
Mm. Sounds rough.
I'm just so worried. Are you listening to me?
Yeah. Your mom. Yeah, right.
Could you just put the book down? And the boys are just so wild. It's like they have rockets attached to them or something.
Rockets?
Yeah, they're just really wild. And I can't even talk to my mom without them tearing the house apart. If I could just talk to her and really have a good conversation, but I can't. It's like they know I'm on the phone and they're extra bad. And if I could just, what are you thinking about?
Starships.
Huh? What's a starship?
You know, Elon Musk is building these big rockets. They're like 400 foot tall and they're made out of stainless steel and they burn methane and he's planning on going to Mars with them.
But why are you thinking about rockets?
He said something about rockets. I don't exactly know what this is all about, but I'm pretty sure it's not about rockets. Thanks, honey. All right. Now, listening well is an unnatural behavior for a variety of reasons. Mostly because we like to talk better than we like to listen. Another reason is because we prejudge everything people say instead of actually just hearing what they are saying. Well, the first part of this talk is going to be mostly to the men. Why mostly to the men? Well, there's three reasons. First, I'm a man, so it feels a little more familiar. Secondly, it's because men often actually aren't very good listeners. And the third reason is because both the Bible and social science strongly indicate that when there's problems in a relationship, it's usually the man's job to fix it, and he has the most influence to do so. So often, we men complain about things in the relationship, like, this isn't working right. And that's pretty ignorant, because when there's problems in the relationship, it is the man's job to fix it. It's like complaining about being motion sick when you're the one flying the plane. We prioritize what we see is important. So how many of you, if you're sitting down with, I don't know, your boss for your annual review, or maybe it's your biggest customer and this is a make or break it job for your institution, for your business, you just zone out. Like, person's over there talking and you're just looking off thinking about starships or something fascinating like that. We generally find ways to pay attention to things that really matter to us. Now, there's this verse in Proverbs that has been intriguing to me for a long time. So, of course, we're all familiar with Proverbs 31, and that's the case of it goes down through all the virtues of the virtuous wife. And there's this long list of things. And right in the middle of it, just kind of non-sequitur, just dropped in the middle like it doesn't belong there, and it says, her husband is known in the gates where he sitteth among the elders of the land. And then it goes on talking about the woman. Like, wait, stop, hey, something don't seem right about this. I've had questions about that verse for a long time. And one reason is, why is that? So the gate was the place of judgment and decisions, and the husband was an honored figure sitting in the gate. He's known in the gates where he sitteth among the elders, or the honored decision makers of the land. And I said, what's going on here? It doesn't say anything about the husband. And why is he worthy to sit in the gate just because his wife is a virtuous woman? I mean, I can see why she might be sitting in the gate. That makes sense. But what if he's kind of a loser, actually? I mean, sometimes women are married to, virtuous women are married to losers. And so what's going on here? You know, we've all known men that they've just climbed the ranks. I mean, whether it be in a business or whether organization or whatever it is, they've just climbed unnaturally fast. And we look at him and we say, of course, his dad is like the owner. That's why he's the foreman. Or his grandpa owns most of the stocks, the voting stocks in that company. And yeah, he's probably grooming him to take over. And we get that because there's somebody in the organization or somebody who has a lot of power who is able to help this person up. We get that. We don't even, we look at it and sometimes we roll our eyes a little bit because we think maybe they've been advanced above their education level. But we understand. It's not a stretch for us to look at that and say, yeah, his dad's the owner. No wonder he's a foreman. Because this person that's climbing the ranks unnaturally fast has a helper, has a mighty helper way up there that's saying, we're going to move him up. Now, in Genesis, it says that that God said, I will make a help meet for him. That's the wife. And there's a problem with that. There really is. I think I understand why the translators translated it like this. Beverly Campbell, in her book, explains even the choice of Eden. According to the biblical scholar David Friedman, the Hebrew word translated thee in English as help is ezer. This word is a combination of two roots, one meaning to rescue, to save, and the other word meaning to be strong. Just as the roots merged into one word, so did their meanings. At first, ezer meant either to save or to be strong, but in time, says Friedman, Ezer was always interpreted as to help, a mixture of both nuances. So we have this idea of help, of strength and the ability to help, and they kind of blended the words together. There's a problem with that in our modern English, though, because we see helper as the one that kind of tags along behind and just helps. Like Junior is helping Mom take the wash off the line. Who's in charge? Mom's in charge. Mom's actually taking the wash off the line and Junior's dragging it through the mud puddles. We understand that. Helpers sometimes aren't even very much helpers. And we have this idea of, sometimes I think we fall in this trap of having the idea of the wife as the little helper. That is not what this word means. David Webb, in her book, Forgotten Women of God, also clarifies this word by explaining the noun ezer occurs 21 times in the Hebrew Bible. In 8 of these instances, the word means Savior. These examples are easier to identify because they're associated with other expressions of deliverance or saving. Elsewhere in the Bible, the root ezer means strength. The word is most frequently used to describe how God is an ezer to man or to Israel. That is a magnificently shocking difference between the way we look at helper today and the way it's being described here. God is not Israel's little helper. God is the mighty force that allows Israel to continue in existence. I think a good working translation for this morning of helper is a mighty ally. I think that works. Because God is a mighty ally to Israel. Okay, so a virtuous wife is a mighty ally. And men who learn to talk to their wives and listen to their wives are in a much stronger position than men who don't. And it's easily enough to make the difference between success and failure, between mediocrity and overwhelming accomplishment. I want to stop just a moment and think about a character from history. We find him. It was a boy named Temujin. Not sure that's a correct pronunciation, but Temujin. And he had a wife. He lived way out in the steppes of Mongolia. He was basically a tribal herder, hunter. in a one person, in a one little tribal leader in a whole bunch of scattered tribes, a irrelevant figure in history. He had a wife. He got married early in life, and his wife got taken away from him. So later, him and some of his family mounted an attack on the neighboring tribe. And they galloped in there and proceeded to, they galloped down into the enemy village and they proceeded to attack the enemy tribe. And he went ahead of the charge and he was calling, he was riding his horse because they were all mounted warriors, riding his horse and he kept calling his wife, Borti, Borti, Borti. And she was running with everybody else because there was this attack coming into the village. Even though she was a captive there, she's running. And she hears this voice, Borti, Borti, and she turns around and she runs back. And Temujin is leaning down, is riding his horse, and she runs up to him. And he leans down out of his saddle, and he puts his arm around her. She runs up to him, and they are reunited. He's known for taking her advice repeatedly. He also took advice from his mother, and he had other wives, and later, and he was known for taking advice from his wives. We do not know him today as Temujin. We know him today as Genghis Khan, the great Genghis Khan, who in one lifetime went from a herd boy living out in the wilds and hunting from horseback to building the greatest land empire in world history. His empire, he conquered a vast territory spanning from the Pacific Ocean to the Danube River and to the shores of the Persian Gulf. At its peak, the empire covered approximately 9 million square miles. I think a lot of times us people in the East, in the West, we don't know that much about what happens in other parts of the world. But this is the great Genghis Khan, who built the biggest land empire in world history, the biggest continuous land empire in world history. And he's known for managing his empire partly by the advice of his wives, especially his first one. Well, there was a couple of them that really, he in fact parceled off parts of his empire and said, here, you, wife, you be in charge of this portion and you be in charge of that portion. It's interesting because some men seem to think we're sacrificing our manhood if we go to our wife or our mom for advice. Maybe nobody hears that way, but I think that is something that makes inroads definitely in the world, but I think even in our Anabaptist churches sometimes. But what we're really sacrificing instead of is our ability to climb above the troubles we find ourselves mired in. David famously took advice from Abigail, and it saved him from a major mistake that could have sustained his whole future kingdom. Now, I want to just pull out a minute here. Some of you are thinking, hey, look, I can't talk to my wife about stuff, and hopefully this isn't a problem here. But sometimes, and thankfully it's not a problem in my life, but sometimes I think men think, I can't talk to my wife about stuff like that because she's kind of, you know, how do we say this, a gossip. Well, I can see where that could be a problem. But there's two things I would like to say about gossips. That's often hung on women. But two of the worst gossips I've ever known in my life were men. That's point number one. And point number two is, I think sometimes men leave their wives vulnerable because they won't listen to them and they won't talk to them. And so there is somebody that will listen to them and will talk to them, and it's a community gossip because she's picking up whatever scraps she can. And so the wife turns into a gossip because, hey, here's at least one group of people who will listen to her. So while, if that is a problem, then I think it's the husband's job to rectify it. But just beating on the problem is not a very wise way forward if we haven't examined our own life issues to see if maybe we're the problem. One of the reasons that a woman is a mighty ally if they're virtuous is because the Bible Proverbs repeatedly makes the link between virtue and wisdom and virtue. And so if a woman is virtuous, she's probably wise. It just kind of goes together. It's part and parcel of the same thing. And we learn to listen when we see the value in what another has to share. Until then, it's just technique. It's not that there isn't anything to be said for technique. Good technique is learned, But it's learned much faster when we really want to hear what the other person has to say. It's true whether we're running a household or whether we're running an empire. It's how we access the power of the mighty ally and how the man in Proverbs became known in the gates. We listen when we think we need to listen to others because it's the right thing to do and it will make them feel better. We only half listen. And we probably miss the point. We do not know how another feels until we've truly heard them out and empathized with them. We cannot do that by just being nice. We have to let go of the familiar, safe shore of our own thoughts, opinions, judgments, and worldviews long enough to enter into somebody else's world and really hear it. It's as much an emotional experience as an intellectual one. It may be more. A technical approach has the very real danger of going off the rails and appearing manipulative because it's hard to control all of our body language. You know what I mean by body language, the way your feet and hands and what you do with your eyes and all this. Because we're trying to pretend like we're listening when in reality we're thinking about starships and our body language is all off whatever our subconscious is actually doing. But if you actually want to hear what the other person has to say, then we naturally tend to throw correct signals because we're in the correct frame of mind, and our subconscious, which controls things like our nonverbal cues, tends to just make everything line up. But you say, my wife doesn't know anything about what I do. Like, my job is complicated and kind of secretive, and she doesn't know anything about it. So how's she going to give me good advice, honestly? There's just a lot she don't understand. How is scrubbing the floor at home going to prepare her for dealing with all the important people that I have to deal with every day? Well, that's an interesting problem. Because what it means is we've been doing such a spectacularly bad job of communicating and valuing our wife up to this point, she's pretty much useless to us. She's certainly not the mighty ally that God had intended for us. Imagine if we're needing tax advice, and so we sit down with our accountant and we say, I need help, I need advice. And he says, okay, great, let's see your records. And you say, I didn't bring my records. I'd rather not show you my records. Let's just let bygones be bygones, and can we just start from here? What do you think? He's going to look at you a little strange. Because how is he supposed to help you if there's nothing to help you with? So if we're going to let our spouses be the mighty ally God intended for them to be, we're going to have to keep them in the loop. So if a ferocious and evil warlord and later an empire builder can do this, surely you would think that us people who are born again and have the Spirit of God in us might be able to do it almost as well. If Christianity has enabling power, it certainly should enable us to do what we need to do. So if we look at our lives and we realize our wife can't advise us on issues because we've kept them so in the dark, that's terrible. In fact, it's unacceptable. So if that's the solution, the situation we find ourselves in, we have two options. We can either continue with the dysfunctional status quo, hey, that's the way it is, can't be fixed now, or we could try something better. I'm a big believer in the right of humans to choose. Nothing is being forced on anybody here, and I'm definitely an offender, so I'm preaching to myself. But if we're going to be choosing, then it makes sense to know what we're choosing. If we're going to be choosing between two options, we should at least know what the options are. Because what we're actually choosing is between having a mighty ally and having a live-in servant. We're choosing between having a friend and having somebody that just does the laundry. And the relationship is not the same. And Jesus bore down on that point late in his life. Or he brought that point out, that exact point. And he says, I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything I have learned from my Father I have made known unto you. And the Father has a pretty complex business to keep track of with 7 billion people in the world. And so Jesus is saying it's safe. Jesus is going on record here saying that to keep someone in the dark about your business is to treat them as a servant and not as a friend. And some people feel that the relationship in their marriage is not what it could be. And so now we start to understand why. Are we treating our wife like a servant? And it's a harsh question, and the possibility is that there's a harsh answer. And Jesus says a servant doesn't know his master's business, and a friend does. And that's God's distinction. That's not my distinction. I didn't make that up. We're trying to do something in the wrong way. and we're not following the instructions. We're not following what it means to really be in relationship with somebody. And when we don't follow the instructions that have been given to us, inevitably bad things happen. Reminds me, one of my friends is a retired from the Air Force, a lieutenant colonel, and he tells about bombing Cambodia in B-52s before he became an Anabaptist years ago. And he said one day they'd flown off Guam, off the rock. They call it the Rock, Anderson Air Force Base, and they'd flown 6 hours, something like 6 hours, to Cambodia. And they'd done a bombing mission, and they were flying back at 40,000 feet, and they're bored to tears. All they do is sit there and stare out the front of the airplane as it cruises along at 40,000 feet over the Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean, with nothing but water for hundreds and hundreds of miles, so just huge, great ocean, Pacific Ocean, and nothing happening. And I think it was maybe the electronic warfare officer, which sits behind the two pilots, he looks over, and there's this breaker panel with all these pop-out breakers. Most of you men know what I'm talking about. There's little breakers that pop out, and you can pop them back in to reset them, unlike the ones in the house that flip. But it's the same principle. And electronic warfare officer looks over, and there's a breaker popped. And he's bored. So he pops the breaker back in, pops back out. He's still bored, so he pops the breaker back in, pops back out. The book is very clear about this. You don't push a popped breaker in more than twice. But they're all bored, and now they're all sitting there watching the electronic warfare officer like, I wonder what would happen if he pops it in again. Electronic warfare officer is bored. It's, I don't know, 40 degrees below zero outside and not enough oxygen to live, and they're in this little aluminum, well, huge aluminum tube, cramped though it was. And the electronic warfare officer thinks, am I going to obey the book? No, he's bored. So he reaches out and he holds the breaker in. Sits there and holds it in. What do you think happened? Smoke starts pouring out from behind the panel. All of a sudden, they realize they have a problem because there's not enough oxygen up here to breathe outside the airplane. It's 40 degrees below zero, and they have a crisis right now. And one of the men downstairs comes blasting up out of the black hole with his fire extinguisher, and the electronic warfare officer jumps back, and the smoke thins out and goes away. Oh, so they're going to make it home. And Vince tells the story, and he says, why did Boeing manufacturer that made the B-52 say, don't pop, push and pop breakers more than twice? Well, they made the airplane, and the reason they did that is because they wanted people to get home. They didn't want them to die over the Pacific Ocean. They didn't do it because they wanted bored pilots and electronic warfare officers to not have anything to do. And when we don't follow the directions that God gave us, God gives us directions because he wants us to get home, not because he doesn't want us being bored. So if we've been given this charge of listening to our wives and bringing our wives in, we should just follow the directions, because if we don't, things break. But one of the most important reasons for being willing to change is that we're not being the image of Christ that we should be. I mean, think about it. What if we would continually, as church, as his church, continually be reaching out, and he's like, I'm reading. That would not be a good situation. We all recognize that. So Christ's likeness is responding in the situation the same way Christ would. And we'll struggle to pass on our Christ-likeness to our children if they can't see it in us. It's hard to pass on what we don't have, isn't it? And that's the crux of the matter. Not listening and not keeping our wives in the loop is a failure of Christ-likeness. And I'm probably more guilty than most. I'm speaking from experience. And I'm not proud of it. But we all have things in our life we're not proud of. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Because it's personal, it's a moral issue, and it directly reflects on the image of Christ in us, or the failure thereof. So we commit to change or we don't. If we say yes, we're essentially recommitting, because it was actually part of what we committed to when we got married. If we haven't been doing it up to this point, it just means that we're not keeping part of our marriage commitments. Imagine if you woke up one morning, 10, 15, 20 years into your marriage, and you realized, I was supposed to be providing for my wife. That's a ridiculous thought. All of us know, before we get married, you go to work, you go to the dairy barn, whatever you do, you provide for your wife. That's your job. But what if you just woke up one morning and you realized, I've been married for 15 years and I never knew this was part of the job? You can say, hey, look, we've made out this long, let's just let it roll. Or we could say, okay, let's do our job. But how do we do it? Honestly, it's tough. I mean, it's hard, and there is sort of a technical element to it. Because listening is a skill. The problem is most of us men, if we really want to know how to do something, we figure out how to do it. If the whole business or dairy operation or something is going to grind to a halt until we can figure this out, we'll figure it out. Or we'll call in an expert to help us figure it out. We will get it done. We won't just sit there and say, oh, this is terrible. I guess we're going to go bankrupt. I don't know how this fuse panel or this breaker panel works, so we're just, honey, that's it. Might as well pack up and head for the hills. We say, hey, we'll do whatever we have to do. We're going to figure this thing out. Just some points. The speaker should feel free to speak. And that's obvious, but so often I think, and this part doesn't just apply to men, it applies to everybody. Do encourage people to speak. I had a bishop in North Carolina who, when you would talk to him, he would go, I'm talking about the way I was doing it a minute ago. He was encouraging you to keep talking. Like, oh yeah. And he would kind of just keep nudging you. He wasn't interrupting the conversation. He was just kind of, I'm paying attention. Just making those little one phrase, one word answers or nods. And so you feel free to keep talking, or you should, because he's listening. He's not staring off into space thinking about starships. He's not looking at his book and saying, because that's the only thing his mind can think of right now because he's really thinking about his book. You're encouraging the people to keep talking. Removing distractions. Do you know they've done studies that the simple presence of a smartphone lying on a table during a conversation degrades quality of conversation? It just blows my mind. Much less, yeah, sure, scroll. Hey, look, this is a great TikTok clip. A blank smartphone that may not even belong, I think in the one study, it may not have even belonged to either participant. Just lying there. Somebody comes into your office, you can say, yeah, sure. Or you can shut your computer, screens all go black, look at them, turn in your chair, person's free to talk. Removing distraction, because the human mind is prone to distraction. And so we shouldn't give it too many opportunities to escape. Put away your phone, turn off your computer screen. A whole list of things that we could do there. But the one I want to arrive at is empathy. Empathy and patience. Often we're too in a hurry to actually listen to somebody, and people take time. It's hard to actually listen to somebody because we're busy. But it's like Stephen Covey said in his 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. He said, you can be efficient, time efficient with things. He said, you cannot be efficient with things, people. Doesn't work. Can't be efficient with people. He said, you can be effective with people or ineffective with people, but you cannot be efficient with people. If you try to be efficient with people, you will be ineffective with people. You just have to push all back, all that other stuff, or say, hey, I need you to call me back in 10 minutes. You're important. I'm in the middle of something. I can't concentrate, but if you call me back, I'll be ready to listen. That's acceptable a lot of times. But let's not just keep doing what we're doing and say, yeah. Oh, what did you say again? There's also, I call it the 4-second rule. Because a pause, even a long pause, does not necessarily mean the speaker is finished. So we're familiar with the 3-second rule, you know, where the piece of cheese falls on the floor and we grab it up because, you know, germs don't get it in less than 3 seconds. It's bogus. But the 4-second rule would be when somebody finishes a sentence, you just sit there for 4 seconds. Because they may just be collecting their thoughts. People don't want to have to keep talking at this rate of speed the whole time because they're afraid that if you stop for a breath one time, you're going to just interrupt them. Give them a chance to stop. Listen for, let them think for 4 seconds and go back to it again. Volume and tone, as much as 70% of communication is nonverbal, it's been estimated. And we all know this because it's a scenario where if the wife's frustrated about something and she comes and talks to the husband and he's not paying attention and finally he's like, well, what do you want me to do? She's like, nothing. Everything will be fine. Okay, great. Nothing. Everything will be fine, right? Try it. No, things mean what they mean in context. And so you have to listen to the whole thing the person is saying, not just the words. in order to understand. Now, I want to recommend a specific book to you, and then I'll get into a few more steps. This isn't written by a Christian, but I've listened to an audible a couple times, and now I have the written version. It's called I Hear You by Michael S. Sorensen, The Surprisingly Simple Skill Behind Extraordinary Relationships. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on Audible. Probably get it through Barnes & Noble. And he sort of lays out the point, the steps to empathy. So what is empathy? What is validation? Well, he says validation has four parts. First, you listen empathically. That's shutting the computer, putting down the phone in your pocket, preferably under the table. There's micro-validation, which is part of listening. That's what I was talking about, the bishop that in North Carolina. You might see two women sitting there staring at each other across the coffee table, and one of them's telling a story, and the other one's saying, wow, really? No way. That's micro-validation. It's completely different. Even though you are injecting a word into the other person's speech, it's not a interruption. An interruption is when you attempt to take the floor from somebody else. Somebody says, and it was just terrible. And you're like, yeah, that reminds me of the time we went out to Nag's Head. And we jump in with our own story. That's an interruption. Microvalidation is simply saying, I'm with you. That's step one. Number two, very important step, is validation, validating the emotion. Brené Brown says, sympathy is not empathy. Sympathy comes from the outside of the situation. Empathy is entering into the situation with the person. Imagine a moment when somebody has fallen into a dark hole. They look up and say, I'm stuck. It's dark. This is overwhelming. Brown says, a sympathetic approach is to say, whoa, that's bad. I'm sorry you're in there. Do you want a sandwich? An empathic response would be to climb down in the hole with them and say, I know what it's like down here. It's tough. You're not alone. You're sitting beside the person. Validation has two parts. The first one is identifying or naming the emotion. Are you feeling torn or... So you're validating the emotion, naming the emotion. And you're finding out what the person believes. And the good thing is if you get it wrong, they'll correct you. And that's not a bad thing. If you say, so are you feeling discouraged? No, I'm not feeling discouraged. Just not really. Just overwhelmed right at the moment. Okay? That's fine. They corrected you. No big deal, because they don't mind it either. Now you're on the same page. You know, you've named it, and then you give reason for why that's a legitimate emotion for them to be feeling. You agree with them. You say, you know what? If I had seven children, I was trying to prepare for giving a talk at Penn Valley, I'd probably feel overwhelmed too. Now the person knows you're with them. And this isn't a moral judgment call. You could validate somebody even if that person has violated a moral standard. You can validate why they felt the way they do. We can never validate bad choices. Say, yeah, that was a right choice to make. No, it's the right choice is always the right choice, and the wrong one's always the wrong one. But you can at least get in the hole with the person, sit down beside them and say, you know what, under the circumstances, I could see why you would feel that way. Now they're listening to you at least. You're on the same page. Step three, so step one is just listening empathically. Step two is validation. Name the emotion and get down in the hole with them and look at the situation from their point of view and say, yeah, I see where you're coming from. Step three is optional but useful in certain situations. You can offer advice or encouragement. And it's usually best to ask, do you want my opinion on that? And sometimes people will say no. Okay, that's fine. Unless they're your child or somebody you're responsible with, that's an acceptable answer. But maybe by this time they really feel heard because you've both gotten into the motion. You've named it. You agree that this is what it is. And this is terrible to be in here with you. Not with you, but this is a terrible situation to be in. And I can see why you feel the way you do. Now they're open to hearing something from you if they're ever going to be. And so you ask them, you want to hear my opinion? Yeah, go ahead. I'm kind of wondering about it. And then and only then we say, well, here's what I think. And then there's one more step. Validating again. You say, what? We just did that. Hey, we did it like three times or something. And there was a whole step dedicated to validating. It doesn't matter. That's how you wrap up a conversation. You validate them again. You say, hey, this is a tough situation. I can see the why you would feel the way you do. I'd feel overwhelmed in that situation too. Person feels heard. So step one, listen empathically. Step two, offer advice. Step two is validate. So it's naming the emotion, getting in the hole with them, looking at it from their point of reference and saying, yeah, I can see why, how this feels. This feels bad. This, you can put yourself into it. This feels bad. I'm in it with you now. Three, offer advice or encouragement. And four, you just validate again, wrap up. Because listening and validation is a skill. I was recently working with one of my friends. We were trying to get breakfast ready for church camping, and we were late, and we're trying to get the fire going, and I didn't have the right stuff because I hadn't brought it. And I looked at him, and I said, do you know how to start fires? And he's like, I don't know anything about starting fires. Okay, that's fine. And I prayed over it, and I wished I had my axe, but in the end, it all worked out fine. But you know what? It was okay for this man to say, I don't know how to start fires. That's fine. But you know, I know this man, and I think if this man's family was freezing, he would start a fire somehow. Okay, so it is a skill, and you have to learn it, but that's okay. If you see a need, you learn the skill. We can learn it, but once again, I just want to loop back one more time. You can do these four steps as a technique. If you don't care about the situation, sooner or later, you're going to probably get caught. If you care about the person, and you're doing a terrible job of validating them, and that's probably a lot more common for a lot of us. We do care about the person, but we're doing a horrible job of validating them. Then it's time to learn a skill and say, okay, so I love this person, but they're not feeling it, so what are we going to have to do to fix this? So let's see if we learned anything at all. You'll get my wife to come back up here. We'll try this again.
I'm really worried about my mom.
Really? Your mom?
Yeah, I just talked to her, and she just really sounds off.
Like off, like how?
I don't know. Something in her voice just doesn't sound right. I can't really put a finger on it, but it just gave me a really bad feeling.
Bad? Like worried, sick, afraid?
No, bad like, well, kind of guilty.
Guilty. That must feel terrible. What makes you feel guilty?
Well, I feel like I should be there for her somehow, but I don't feel like I have time with all the children.
Like you're letting her down somehow? That must be rough. Feeling like you should be there for her and you don't feel like you can.
Yeah, it's really painful.
Well, I can see why. I mean, it would be painful to think you should be there for your mom and you're not. I mean, our mothers were there for us when we needed them, and so we kind of feel like we owe it to them. So, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, the boys are so wild, I feel like I don't have time. And sometimes it's like they have rockets attached to them or something.
Yeah. They have been really wild lately. And that's enough to stress anybody. I'd be stressed, too, if I were you.
Yeah, I am. And when I try to talk to her, they just tear the house apart. And I think if I could just talk to her and really have a good conversation with her. But they can tell when I'm on the phone and they're extra wild.
Yeah, that stinks. Wow. Bet it leaves you feeling torn, like you should be there for your mom and... Yeah, you know the boys need attention too.
Yeah, I do feel really torn.
Could I make a suggestion?
Sure.
I don't have a meeting tonight. What if I would just take the children for a walk after supper, and you could just call your mom, and I can keep them out an hour or so. You think that would help?
We could try that. It might just be nothing, but I don't feel like I can let it go until I have a little talk with her.
Okay. Do you want to do it then?
Sure. Yeah, let's try that.
I'm sure it feels really hard to feel torn like that. I mean, it feels bad to feel strung out between two things. Like, if I know they're my responsibility, it's a bad feeling.
You don't You don't think I'm just being ridiculous then?
Oh, no. I think it feels terrible to be feel like you need to be at two places at once. I'd feel bad if I was stretched out like that, too.
Well, I don't feel as bad about it now that we talked about it. It's probably nothing, but I'd feel better after I talked to her tonight.
Okay. Let's great. Let's do it then. I'll take the boys right after supper.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
That's a very different conversation than the first one. If we know we have a responsibility to do, and we know we are a creature with freedom of choice, and we're going to answer to God for our actions someday, it pays to learn what we need to learn, to become the person we need to become, so that our wife and our children and those around us can see Christ coming out of us in our day-to-day lives. Thank you so much for listening.